Hey, everyone. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I am David Green, and I got to say my favorite time to talk about politics is when you, the voters, have actually spoken and voted. So we're not talking about hypotheticals or making predictions today. We're talking about the choices that you, the voters, actually made this week. Both Mo Alethi and Sarah Isger know moments like this very well. Mo has worked on many a Democratic campaign. Same goes for Sarah on the Republican side. So I guess we can just dig in, right?
Let's do it.
Okay. We're not going to talk about Mississippi. That is a race that I thought was going to be close, that we talked about on the show last week. Yeah, deep red state, and a Democrat was looked like he was going to make it a thing and didn't happen. So this is me falling on my sword and saying the two of you are right. That race went as we expected.
Thank you. That felt good.
Yeah, good.
Podcast done.
Yeah, over. You're always right. Well, so there was this big vote on abortion in Ohio. There was a governor's race in Kentucky where a Democratic incumbent won in, I guess we could say, by doing all he could to separate his race from President Biden's own reelection, which is interesting. But I know you both of you have been pushing for weeks now to talk about the state of Virginia. And just so everyone understands, every seat in the Virginia state legislature was up for grabs this Tuesday. Republicans were really hoping to condense their power behind Governor Glenn Youngkin. Youngkin was deeply involved in rallying support to do that. Ideally for him, a strong Republican performance would set the table maybe for a future presidential run that would highlight his ability to bring the party, the Republican Party, together in a state like Virginia. And instead, Democrats both retained control of the state Senate, also managed to flip control of the House. Let's listen.
The people of the Commonwealth of Virginia have spoken. And what they said was, we won't go backwards. What they said was, we believe in freedom. That nobody has they don't have the blueprint for freedom. We have the blueprint for freedom in the Democratic Party.
That voice there was Don Scott. He is the Democratic leader in the House of Delegates in the state of Virginia. And so let's dig in here. Mo, how significant was this for Democrats, what we saw play out in Virginia?
I mean, it was a good night. And it came at the perfect timing, too, right? Because over the weekend, a bunch of bad polls came out for President Biden. And suddenly there was the requisite amount of Democratic bedwetting, and the entire pundit and consultant class was talking about, was calling for the premature death of the Democratic Party.
These were the polls showing that Trump is ahead, like in a lot of swing states, right?
In a lot of swing states. And that's a real problem. But what we saw in Virginia and in Kentucky and in Ohio is that voters are going to do what they're going to do, regardless of the polls. What I think Virginia, let's focus there first, showed was a couple of things. One, the potency of abortion as an electoral issue. If there was any doubt about the staying power of that issue in the post-Roe era, this last Tuesday should put that to bed, that at least for now, in state after state, in red states and in purple states, abortion is keeping Democrats very much in the game and in many cases putting them ahead. Number two, it shows once again the importance of the suburbs. Virginia flipped the House of Delegates by Democrats winning in a bunch of suburban districts. That can't be understated, or we can't talk about that enough. The suburbs are the ball game in state after state after state, and Republicans are struggling to win over suburban women. So these two issues connected give Democrats in a lot of these battleground states that the president is currently trailing in a roadmap for how they can turn things around heading into 2024. The final point I'll make is anybody who still believes that all politics is local, forget it. Dispel yourself of that notion. In so many of these states, both Democrats and Republicans are running on nationalized messages. And it's potent, it's powerful, and it's working. There's a reason why you are seeing Democrats across the board in blue states, in red states, and in purple states talking about this issue. There's a reason why you see Republicans struggling, right? Even in states where you've got some Republicans who are trying to run as slightly more moderate on the abortion issue, they are struggling to do so if their Democratic opponents can connect them to the national Republican message on abortion. So Virginia, there's so many interesting dynamics in that state, but they are favoring Democrats in a state that is purple. And that's got to give Democrats some reason to feel good as we enter the next year of the 2024 election.
Well, I do just want to say before I give you the floor, Sarah, because I really want all of your broad thoughts, like we just heard from Mo. But is it really true, Mo, that Democrats are showing a national roadmap? I mean, I look at Andy Beshear keeping the governorship in Kentucky, running away from Joe Biden, running away from a national race, saying like this has nothing to do with national politics. This is all about helping Kentucky. Like that feels like an exception to what you're saying.
Donald Trump came in and endorsed Andy Beshear's Republican opponent, Daniel Cameron. It didn't help him, right? It did not. Having that Trump sign stamp of approval did not help Cameron the way they had hoped it would. But Democrats ran ads attacking Cameron on his position on abortion for being so extreme. Even putting victims of rape on the air, talking about how he would force them to carry to term.
So they drew a connection to a national issue like abortion.
To a national issue like abortion. You know, and Andy Beshear wasn't hugging Joe Biden. He wasn't necessarily running away from him either.
He was kind of running away, saying this has nothing to do with the presidential race. Like,
his argument was, I'm going to focus on local issues. I'm going to focus on what works for Kentucky. And then they ran a bunch of ads attacking Daniel Cameron on abortion and on some of the craziness of the National Republican Party. So I do think you're going to see that roadmap play out. We've seen it in Kansas. We've seen it in Ohio. We've seen it in Kentucky. Even in red states, there's a real issue. Coming back to Mississippi real quick.
Oh, sure.
That's one place where the Democrat didn't run on abortion, right? He ran as a pro-life Democrat.
Yeah.
He probably wouldn't have run anyway, right. But it is interesting to see that in red states, this issue continues to motivate voters across the board.
Sarah, thoughts?
I don't know that I buy into the causal arrow here. Like I like to say, the winning team didn't do everything right and the losing team didn't do everything wrong in these races. And just because one side ran all their ads on something and then won doesn't mean that it was because of the ads. And let me give you an alternative explanation for what happened. It's not to say Mo's wrong, but maybe instead of being like 100% of the cause, maybe it's 10%. Like maybe there were a whole lot of other things going on. So let me explain what some of those would be. One, this anytime you have a race ending in an odd numbered year, it's just incredibly low turnout that we're talking about here. And there's not a whole lot you as a political party can do to find voters to come vote in state legislative races, for instance, in Virginia. So you're dealing with the people who are just high propensity voters. They like voting. They think it's their civic duty, yada, yada, yada. So really, really low turnout race. So who are those high propensity donors? They're suburban voters. They're highly educated, usually high income voters. Those used to be Republican voters. That's why Republicans generally did better in midterms and Democrats did better in general elections. It's why you'd always hear Democrats say stuff like, well, if everyone voted, Democrats would always win. It's only because, you know, of lower turnout that then it becomes even or sometimes Republicans win. That's no longer the case because of this political realignment that we've been witnessing for the last 10 years. Democrats are now doing much, much better in the suburbs with high education, high income voters. And it's actually Republicans who have sort of switched over and taken those white blue collar voters or voters of color who fit into that sort of general blue collar category as well. They're low propensity voters. So caution reading too much into any of these races just because from an like this tells us something about 2024 or it undermines the polling about Joe Biden. It's a totally different voting group. So that's number one. Number two, look, Republicans have a big problem. And this highlights that problem, which is in the middle of that realignment, they're now somewhere in between, which is never where you want to be, in between losing some voters and gaining some voters. The voters that are sort of most, you know, enthusiastic general election voters are those Trump voters, the MAGA voters, whatever you want to call them, new Republican voters. They don't seem to care one bit about abortion. So it's here's the 10% I really strongly agree with Mo on. Abortion is now a motivating factor for Democrats in the way that it doesn't seem to be anymore for Republicans. And yes, it's the dog caught the car type thing when Roe got overturned. But in addition, the voters themselves have changed, and these voters don't really care much about that. They care about Donald Trump. He wasn't on the ballot. And those sort of old school Republican conservative voters are feeling pretty disaffected by this new party. They don't really fit into it. It's why you're seeing those suburban voters switch over to become Democrats to begin with. So yeah, Democrats ran all their ads on abortion and they won a lot of races. You can see why I think those are connected, but not causal the way that Mo thinks it's providing a national roadmap. There's also, look, just a lot of this was sort of local. Andy Beshear was a very popular incumbent governor in Kentucky whose dad had been the governor, 15 years ago for two terms? So like famous last name and incumbent. Virginia was a red state. It's been turning bluer, you know, to purple, then to now blue. It's going to get bluer and bluer as the population increases in Northern Virginia, and that population tends to be very liberal. Again, Democrats had a good night. I'm not trying to argue otherwise. And I agree, I think, with most of what Mo said. It's just that it explains a lower percentage than it would for me.
But can I just dig into what you just said there at the beginning was really interesting because, and Mo, I'm wondering if you agree with this. Like this realignment you're talking about, if that's what's happening, it feels both important and it's something both parties have to kind of recognize and catch up with in their messaging. If Republicans are, you know, their potential growth is among, you know, more blue collar voters and more diverse voters, and Democrats are doing better among more educated white suburban women, like are both parties, do both parties realize that, or did we see an election right now when particularly the Republican Party like didn't recognize that at all, but that maybe there's something that the Democrats need to do if that's an alignment that really is happening?
Look, the Democratic realignment in the suburbs really began in sort of the mid-aughts, 2005, in Virginia, incidentally, when Tim Kaine was running for governor, and he kind of blew up the traditional Democratic roadmap in the Commonwealth and focused on the suburbs and the exurbs of Northern Virginia and of Hampton Roads. And everyone thought he was crazy for doing it. He did it. And he won. Barack Obama took that same roadmap to help him in his 2008 campaign by focusing on the suburbs and states like Virginia and Colorado and a number of other states. So Democrats have been very deliberate in targeting suburban voters and suburban women specifically now for nearly two decades, and it is paying off. When Democrats win, it is almost always because they hold their traditional coalition and they do very, very well in the suburbs. So that's something Republicans, I think, recognize and have been trying to address. One of the reasons in 2022, in the midterms, they focused so heavily on crime as an issue. It wasn't because they were trying to peel off urban voters. It's because that was an issue they felt was going to be very resonant with suburban voters. Turned out Democrats just had another issue that resonated a little bit more. Democrats are still there. And you know, to Sarah's first point, I'm not going to disagree with it. I think she's absolutely right that this wasn't just an off-year election. This was an off-year election, right? It was an election year that ended in an odd number, which—
Yeah, no midterms, no president yet.
Right. It's going to have a much, much lower turnout. And Sarah's right that that means it's going to be the most energized voters who actually turn out. That in and of itself should tell us something. Because one of the things the recent polls that show Biden trailing Trump are pointing to is an enthusiasm gap, that Donald Trump supporters are more motivated than Joe Biden's supporters. What this week's election should show us is that there is a roadmap for Democrats to actually increase enthusiasm and minimize that gap. And that's going to be critical. It's why so many Democrats are looking at battleground states right now and trying to figure out how they can do what just happened in Ohio, get ballot measures on abortion put on the ballot in time for the 2024 election in the hopes that that generates more enthusiasm, not just amongst swing suburban women, but also amongst Democratic voters who may not be feeling super enthused about the president, but are super enthusiastic about this issue. So I think Sarah's 100% right, but I think that's a reason Democrats should actually feel optimistic. They're found a way to increase Democratic enthusiasm.
We'll pick up right here in just a moment. Mo and Sarah and I will come back to keep talking about the voting that we saw this week here on Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
All right, we're back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm David Green. Mo Alethi is here, Executive Director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. And Sarah Isger is here. She's a senior editor at The Dispatch. And Sarah, Mo was just talking about kind of the roadmap for President Biden and what Democrats might be able to build on from what we saw this week, particularly in the suburbs and particularly if they keep the issue of abortion front and center. And you seemed poised with some thoughts.
Well, I just wanted to focus a little bit more on Ohio because I did find that really interesting. It was so lopsided on the ballot measure itself. And remember, this was a ballot measure that was going to enshrine the right to choice, at least to some greater extent, in the Ohio Constitution.
And we should say Ohio voters voted to do that. I mean, it's now going to be enshrined in the state constitution, abortion rights. Yeah.
Previously, Ohio had a 22-week line. Now it'll be more like viability, so 24 weeks, 25 weeks, something like that. So in some ways, the law isn't going to change a whole lot in Ohio, but the turnout, like the percentage delta, I thought was really, really important. And it, I think, underlines this problem within the Republican Party that you have sort of old-school Republican operatives still thinking abortion is what it was 20 years ago to these voters, but they've got new voters and these voters don't see abortion that way. There's no way that you get to, I mean, nearly 60% in that Ohio ballot measure. That's Republicans voting yes on that ballot measure. I don't know though that it's the same when you look at those races in Virginia. Yes, Democrats won back both houses. And that makes for a splashy headline. And it obviously makes for actually important governing differences in Virginia. But those races were really close. We're talking not too many people turning out at all. And just like, I don't know that it's predictive at all for 2024, except to say that, yeah, Virginia is still a pretty blue state. We already knew that.
I don't know. I mean, look, I agree with you that it is rare that you see an election where there's a singular issue that you can attribute the results to. In an election, everything matters, right? Everything is a cause. Whatever, everything that happens in a campaign ultimately matters. And I think we now have seen enough races, every special election, every referendum, everything that has happened electorally since Roe v. Wade was overturned, where one candidate on either side makes abortion an issue, it is impacting. Is it the only thing impacting? No. But it is having an impact. And that's something Republicans continue to grapple with. And if we want more evidence of how much Republicans are grappling with it, look at the third Republican debate that took place this week, where you had Tim Scott embracing a national ban at a 15-week ban and urging all of his competitors to sign on to that. But you had Nikki Haley and Chris Christie saying, we got to slow our roll here, folks. You have
Ron DeSantis. But they've been saying that the whole time. That wasn't new this time. They've said that since the first debate.
What was interesting was Ron DeSantis, who had just signed a 6-week abortion ban in the state of Florida, starting to backpedal a little bit. Not saying he regrets what he did, but suddenly saying, you know what? Every state's should handle this differently. I recognize that what works in Florida doesn't work elsewhere. And so really trying to distance himself from the conversation about a national ban when not just a few months ago, he was putting himself forward as a national model for Republicans on how to handle this issue. So I think this is going to continue to be a challenge, right? Even Donald Trump, who takes credit for the composition of the court that overturned Roe, now keeps saying Republicans don't know how to talk about this issue. We need to.
I mean, they don't. I mean,
there's
no doubt they don't know how to talk about this issue. I think we saw that in Ohio. But I guess, Mo, my question is, I go back to something you said, that this is an issue that can help provide a roadmap for Democrats to keep the White House at a time when a lot of voters are really meh on President Biden. But like, what if abortion sort of falls off in the next year as an issue that's really prominent? What if Republicans figure out a way to just not talk about it and to focus on other things? Do Democrats really want to be in a position where the best case roadmap is, oh, let's focus on this issue as much as we possibly can to kind of hide the fact that we have an incumbent who's not popular? Like, I just looked at some of those polls we've been talking about. I mean, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania, Arizona, Georgia, like Trump is winning. Is abortion really going to be the thing that gets Biden kind of over the line and makes him more competitive in some of those states?
It will be one of
the things. And just to wait, let me add to that, Mo, and all of those Ohio voters who voted yes to get to 60% in Ohio on that ballot measure, they're still voting for Donald Trump.
They're not going to vote for Joe Biden. I agree with that. Right?
That's a problem for the Democrats.
But Ohio is not a battleground state anymore. True. Georgia is. Pennsylvania is. Arizona is. And those states are going to be incredibly close, very, very close. And so having an issue that can help with the margin matters. Should it be the only thing Democrats talk about? Absolutely not. And if I gave that impression, I apologize. It should not be even close to the only thing that they talk about. But we have seen now the power of it as an arrow in the quiver, that it can help with the margins. It can help goose turnout amongst Democrats, and it can help with some swing voters who may be on the fence. And look, let's be honest, in a race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, there ain't a lot of swing voters.
You've given me a good segue saying that abortion is not the only thing to talk about, because I do want to turn to another issue that is going to be also front and center in the presidential race, and it's immigration. And, you know, President Biden, like a string of presidents before him, is under pressure from all sides. He has been for a while to articulate some kind of clear policy to both strengthen the U.S. southern border and provide opportunities for migrants who are coming into the United States. Last month, he requested $105 billion from Congress to support Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan, but also beef up border security. He was looking for $14 billion at the border, wanted to increase the number of Border Patrol agents, more inspection machines to detect fentanyl, more staffers for asylum cases. Senate Republicans have now come back and said the president wasn't doing nearly enough. And so this week, they've asked for a lot more. They said their proposals are required if they're going to approve any new money for Ukraine. So Republicans want more Border Patrol agents. They want to restart construction of the border wall. They want to make anyone who traveled through another country ineligible for asylum. They want a return of the Remain in Mexico policy that forces asylum seekers to stay out of the United States while their cases are being processed. Some Democrats have said this is a non-starter, and so here we are again, an impasse over immigration on the Hill. And meanwhile, You have cities like New York and Chicago desperate for the Biden administration to help figure out a way to grant work permits for new arrivals so migrants in those cities can start filling jobs. So this is something the president is going to deal with from a policy standpoint and also from a political standpoint. And I guess, Sarah, how do you see the pressure that he is under, and is he handling it well, you could argue, with all these competing forces?
Look, Joe Biden has a lot on his plate right now. And I think he would agree. There are any number of things that I think he's thinking about for his legacy and for posterity, and immigration isn't one of those things. That's a problem because politically, I think it will be an extremely salient issue in 2024. You've got voters on the right, as I said, who within the Republican Party, immigration has largely supplanted other issues like abortion and even crime. When you're really looking at what motivates those Republican voters on turnout, it's immigration. So the more that the Biden administration fails on that immigration question, the more the numbers go up, encounters at the border, getaways, you know, they're getting a whole lot of that information all the time from right-wing news outlets, be it Fox News or somewhere else. So politically, I think it's incredibly damaging as a turnout model for the right. In terms of sort of the independent voters, the middle voters, you know, will something like immigration be more motivating than, say, the economy? No, but it goes to an overall incompetence problem that I think the Biden administration has been struggling with. They just don't have their hands around anything. They don't have their hands around inflation. They don't have their hands around, you know, Israel. They don't have their hands around Ukraine. They don't have their hands around immigration. So it's more of like it adds to this bucket of, you know, overflowing with problems for them for the middle. From a policy standpoint, you know, they're in a tough spot, or not from a policy standpoint. Let me just think about it from the left for a moment, because it is like, you know, the more heated conversations that we've had about Israel and Palestine. This is an issue that really divides the left. It's part of what's driving that realignment. You have sort of those suburban voters who are not affected by immigration in the same way, because, you know, an immigrant coming to do cheap labor in their communities isn't going to take their jobs. But that's not true for some of these blue collar voters. So those blue collar voters that are moving, that used to be sort of the backbone of the Democratic base, labor, et cetera, they're moving to the right. And this is one of the issues that's driving them there. And you also have the immigration problem of schools, hospitals, just overwhelming communities that you see Democratic mayors like Eric Adams talking about, governors talking about, where
begging the president for help, begging the federal government to do something.
Right. That's just, again, it's, I don't think you're going to then have Democratic voters vote for Donald Trump, obviously, but it might have them stay home where they're just like, this, like, they don't even know how much this is affecting me now. You know, my kid's school is struggling because they don't have enough desks. Or I went to the emergency room because my kid broke their arm and we had to wait 6 hours because there were all sorts of people there who don't have, you know, actual doctors. So they just go to emergency rooms. It's moving in a more national way, affecting people. It's driving some of this realignment, and the Biden administration doesn't have their hands around it at all. That's a problem.
You know, even if they have their hands around it, and Mo, this is what I'm feeling from President Biden that's lacking. It's leadership. Like I this is really hard, but I, as someone watching him deal with all of this stuff, I mean, dealing with Republicans on the Hill who say more money at the border, and then dealing with mayors like Eric Adams in New York saying, you got to do something to help me with these work permits. Like it, if he does have a handle on this, and if the administration has a handle on it, I am not feeling a sense of leadership and a clear articulation of priority from this president. And that, I mean, you tell me why that's not a problem as we're getting closer to his reelection bid.
Immigration has been the greatest failure of leadership for every president since Ronald Reagan, right? It is not an issue that anybody has handled well. It is not the example of either party putting its best foot forward.
Bush, George W. Bush showed flashes of potential before the Iraq War, like bringing the parties together and working with Kennedy. I think that's the last time you saw a president, but then he he fell into the same trap after.
Right. They all, nobody knows how to handle it because the politics are near impossible to navigate in today's day and age with the way our politics work, with the way our Congress works, with the way, with the hyperpolarization that exists out there. There is maybe no more difficult issue to handle, right? You have both parties out there actually talking about some of the same things. They're just not talking about them at the same levels. And so rather than, the, you know, border security is a good example of where both parties are actually talking about it and they can probably find some a compromise where neither side is totally happy, but they can make it work. But they won't make it work. You outlined an example at the top of the segment. You know, the president put forward a border security proposal. Republicans said it's not enough, so we're going to kill the whole damn thing. Republicans will go out there and do the same thing, and Democrats say that's not the right focus, and so we're going to kill the whole damn thing. So both parties have failed on this for decades. And I think, you know, the president's stuck in a place where the politics are just getting uglier and the situation is becoming more complicated. Now, I have seen some interesting ideas being floated, especially around the issue of work permits, that I think could be interesting from both a policy and a politics perspective. You know, this Gavin Newsom in California recently signed a bill that would give him the authority to work with the federal government to sort of quote unquote parole certain undocumented people to give them work permits, particularly farm workers. And there's a growing movement out there to do more of that on a state-by-state basis, right? You've even seen in some Republican states like Utah and Indiana that are looking for and have openly called for state-specific immigrant work permits for certain industries where they are facing labor shortages.
But you've got attorney generals suing, like 20 attorney generals from Republican states suing the Biden administration for using this sort of parole approach. I mean,
right?
So even
but
that's
if,
a,
but if you were to do it on a state by state basis, and you look at some of these Republican states like Indiana and like Utah, maybe there's a path to deal with it. And if you've got Republican governors calling for it, maybe we can actually get something done. And it would be interesting from a political perspective. How does each party react to that? So, you know, I think it's going to continue to be complicated. I think it is, neither party is showing a whole hell of a lot of seriousness in tackling it right now. And there could be some interesting, but options out there if anyone has the political will to push it.
All right, we're going to come back and talk about this and also talk about one state where one of their important industries has actually relied on people who are fleeing a war-torn country abroad and coming in to fill some important jobs. We'll talk about that and more. We'll be right back with more Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back again with Left, Right, and Center. And a moment ago, Mo was talking about the idea of using parole, which is an option within immigration law that the Biden administration has been using. To allow people to be in the country legally, temporarily. They recently approved temporary protected status for nearly 500,000 Venezuelans living in the United States as of this summer. And I guess, Sarah, I know one of the complaints legally from some Republicans is that this is executive action that the Biden administration is using too often and not just in select cases. Is that the core of the objection to this?
I mean, there's a lot of objections to the overall problem with immigration, right? Because there's not one thing that we need to fix. We need to fix the whole thing. What's weird is that other countries actually don't have a problem with this. There's no other country in the world that handles immigration the way that we do. But anyway, that's a tangent all on its own. One other thing to mention, though, is that it's a bit of whack-a-mole, right? There's also not a single cause of immigration that lasts. Every few years, the, you know, who's showing up at the southern border, for instance, changes pretty dramatically. So when you think about individual policy choices that the Biden administration's facing, to some extent, it's a little unfair because any single change doesn't fix the problem. Again, the executive branch alone won't fix this at all. It will have to be Congress actually doing its job, and it's going to be all of the above. It's going to be border security. It's going to be work permits. It's going to be legal immigration. It's going to be merit-based instead of chain migration, all of these things. And we're just not even, we're not even having that conversation.
Well, what we are talking about, you know, a lot of parts of this, and including, you know, figuring out a way to get work permits potentially for asylum seekers in New York City and Chicago, elsewhere. And that's kind of important context as we move to a guest we have on the show today. I think I mentioned last week how in the run-up to the 2024 presidential election, we're going to try on the show to zoom in on every state in the country to dig into some stories, some themes we might be missing as we dissect the national headlines. And this week, we're going to go to Alaska. And it's a state that has found a way to bring people into the United States to fill some really important jobs. Seafood is a really essential industry in the state of Alaska. The industry brings in over $5 billion to the state's economy, and it's been relying on workers arriving from war-ravaged Ukraine. And one person who's been working a lot on bringing them here is Brian Gannon. He's president and founder of the Ukraine America Initiative. And Brian, thanks for giving us some of your time today.
Hey, thanks. Thanks a lot, David. Glad to be here.
Can you just give us the sort of top line? I mean, your connection to this industry and how you're involved and what actually you're doing to bring these Ukrainians here?
Yeah, sure. So I've worked personally in the seafood industry in Alaska starting in the early 90s. It was populated heavily by college students, university students from Northwest America to work in these processing plants to process the fish that the fishermen catch.
My college roommate and from Montana was one of those people, so I've heard about that personally. Right. Yeah.
And then in the late 90s, just the bottom completely dropped out of domestic employment or the desire for people to work in Alaska. Starting just right before then, we started using J-1 students through a Department of State program that allowed us to bring people in during their university break from other countries. We segue that to now, David, where we're using a visa from the Department of Labor that has some step in from Department of Homeland Security and Department of State. And it's more of a labor visa rather than a cultural exchange visa like the J-1 visa. And the Alaska seafood industry needs anywhere from 4,000 to 8,000 outside workers to maintain production levels for the fish that's being harvested. So my company brings in anywhere from 4,000 to 8,000 workers in on this program from the Department of Labor that is a seasonal visa program, and they come in to support the wild harvest fisheries in Alaska. They work, they earn, they return, they go home. So largely speaking, it is an immigration program that's working.
And the program that you're doing this under, I mean, you said it's a labor program. It's the H-2B visa, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So it's for seasonal employers. Employers have to show and prove to the government that they are seasonally based.
The temptation would be to look at what you're doing and look at Alaska and be like, does it have to be that complicated? It seems like it's so simple and you can do something good. I know there are 18 layers, but say more about why you think this is, as you said, an immigration program that's working and what kind of message that it might be sending, you know, to everyone.
Yeah. So I've been recruiting, David, overseas as well as domestically. We're not, you know, forsaking domestic workers, but we're augmenting the domestic workers who want to work in Alaska. But we go to some of the rougher places on earth to find some people that are willing to come and work in Alaska. One of those places was Ukraine. You know, the average mid-career professional in Ukraine, say a 35-year-old, doesn't matter if he was a doctor or, you know, laying paving stones, that person's making $350, $400 per month. Where in Alaska, they might make $250 a day. And so they adhere to the rules. They come, they earn, and they return. Most of the workers from the specific countries for our program, just looking at our statistics from our company and the client companies that we work with, we had like a 98.5% return to country rate. But being in remote Alaska is different than being in New York City or, you know, anywhere in between. There's not a diaspora pulling you to go work with your cousin in Chicago or greater opportunity somewhere else. These people work in a remote community. They might work up to 15, 16 hours a day. They work very hard. They earn their money. They don't pay for housing. They don't pay for food. And then they go home. So it is kind of fascinating if we looked at it from the perspective of somebody traveling from somewhere else. Doesn't matter if it's the Northern Triangle or Ukraine. They're coming for a better life, and they earn. But these people also want to go home. This is not an immigration play. They're not trying to move to America. They want to make money
and go home. Then go home. Can I ask? I mean, what's interesting is, you know, your program uses the H-2B visa, mm-hmm. but when it comes to Ukraine, I mean, President Biden did use the parole system to give temporary status to some yeah. Ukrainians who are elsewhere in the country. And Sarah, yeah. I want to ask you, like, there's this lawsuit from some Republican states. They are calling into question the Biden administration's use of parole for migrants from Cuba, from Haiti, from Nicaragua, from Venezuela. But they seem to have no problem with Ukrainians coming in under a parole system. And it's like the instinctive reaction is like that's sort of using that it might be making a choice based on race or what country you're from. It doesn't feel good to me that there might be some picking and choosing as to what countries people can come from. Like what would be the argument to say, like, yes, Ukrainians broadly can come into the United States, but we're going to challenge you in court when it comes to letting people from like Venezuela or Cuba come under a parole program?
Well, often there's different legal standards based on the State Department's sort of, decision of which countries are in what sort of dire straits. We've seen that certainly, when Haiti has an earthquake hit or something, people who are here in the country from Haiti then are not going to be sent back to a country that has just had a natural disaster. So there are some legal differences. But I think it's what Brian just said. The folks that he's describing want to go home. Republicans are great if you want to come here and work and go home. It's the idea that people then use visa overstays or work permits to try to stay in the country or disappear into the country that I think Republicans have the biggest problem with from a policy standpoint. And so, you know, they're seeing an opportunity. And again, I think every administration, to Mo's point, has really struggled is the wrong term, failed at this in whatever ways they try. But the idea that you just through executive action are going to fix this problem by giving some work permits. No, the problem is there's a whole lot of people making an incredibly dangerous trip with all sorts of incentives to come through the southern border. That's not what Brian's describing in Alaska. And so it's very, very different.
Brian, let me give you the last word. Any sort of, I don't know, anecdote or image that sticks in your mind as you've watched a lot of these workers, you know, arrive here and do this work?
You know, it's pretty neat because when you go to remote Alaska takes away your visions of America, skyscrapers or whatever you see in the movies that you think is your vision of America if you are not from America. Alaska takes away everything you've just talked about. It's kind of a neutral base that allows people just to work hard, earn, and leave all their worries at home, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, Brian, Brian Gannon is president and founder of the Ukraine America Initiative. Brian, great talking to you, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Have a good day.
You too. All right, we are going to move into the famed left, right, and center rants and raves. I'm going to rant about two of the Republicans who are running for president. Vivek Ramaswamy, when he was talking about TikTok, brought up Nikki Haley's daughter in the Republican debate, saying that maybe Haley should talk to her daughter about her use of TikTok. As a rule, I don't mind bringing up politicians' families, and especially when they're doing things that are in the public eye. I didn't like his tone. I didn't like the way he brought it up. I thought Nikki Haley was right to push back and say that that should be out of bounds. But when she called Ramaswamy scum, that my immediate reaction was, that is so Trumpy, and I want to go back to a politics where we don't call names like that. I think there was a better way to do it. I've actually really enjoyed watching Nikki Haley's rise in the Republican polls, and she's articulated policy in ways that I think has been lacking in some of the other candidates on the stage, and that just really made me sad. I don't think she had to go that low.
No, I'll say, David, when you say, I want to go back to a day when we don't say things like that, I'm not sure that day ever existed. Go back and read what Adams and Jefferson said about each other in their presidential campaign. And Nikki Haley seems downright tame compared to some of that stuff.
Well, I just got schooled in history by Mo Alethe. And that was well deserved. Okay, well, I guess you're volunteering to go next, Mo.
I've got a rave. We talked on the show a couple times about the loneliness epidemic that's happening out there, and its impact on happiness, its impact on mental health, and anxiety, depression, some physical manifestations. It's a real problem. Well, the state of New York this week took a major step in tackling this loneliness epidemic by naming the state's first honorary ambassador to loneliness. And the person they turn to is a sex therapist, maybe the greatest known sex therapist out there, Dr. Ruth Westheimer. The 94-year-old talk show host and sex therapist was named by the governor as the state's honorary ambassador to loneliness. Her job is going to be traveling around the state and talking with New Yorkers about loneliness and helping them think through strategies on how to combat it. I think it is great. Dr. Ruth has a clarity of speech and always has that gets people to listen. And so kudos to her and the governor for finding a way to tackle this very serious issue.
Should we have her on the show?
Absolutely.
Okay. I've got questions.
Yeah, me. We all do. All right, Sarah.
All right, I'm going to rant again about pandas. So this week, all of the pandas in the United States started making their journey back to China. Now, my original rant about all of this is that actually, this is a good thing. First of all, these animals are an evolutionary dead end. And if they weren't so freaking adorable, we wouldn't have spent the money in the first place. But also that we've been spending $1 million a panda to a genocidal ethnocentric regime, China, our adversary, just for the privilege of having them in our zoo. We should be teaching children that pandas are bad. Also, because this is the same country that, God knows, you know, we've been helping with their genetic diversity and their breeding of these pandas, while they have been destroying, for instance, the rhino population by thinking that ivory helps men do, you know, stuff that they can't do on their own. Try Viagra. So the pandas went back today, and then it even seems now that we're paying for the privilege of returning the pandas as I watched the FedEx trucks with pandas inside, which does sound really cute. You kind of want the FedEx truck to, you know, just pour pandas out on the road somewhere, but that's not what happened. I haven't seen the contract, but it looks like we even paid to return the pandas. I'm just outraged. Bye, pandas. Let's have some American animals in our zoos. Like raccoons or possums. Did you know I used to have a pet possum? Owen. R.I.P. Owen.
Owen was your possum's name.
Did you just hold pandas accountable for the decisions of the communist regime in China?
I believe she did.
No, I'm just saying that we shouldn't then be, you know, making heroes out of these pandas either.
She blamed voters a couple weeks ago on the show, and now she's blaming pandas.
I blame voters more than I blame pandas.
Okay. That is all the time we have for today. I love talking pandas.
Why can't they just eat real food, Mo?
Yeah, why not? Love Talking Pandas with Sarah Isger and Mo Alethi, and it was great having Brian Gannon on the show today. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded and mixed by Nick Lamponi. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Big shout out to the staff here at Digital Island Studios in New York City for letting me pop in and do the show from here today. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We are distributed by PRX. I am David Green. Thanks for being here. If you like what you heard, tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center. And RIP Owen.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
From PRX.